Joe, you're back. How you doing?
I'm great, Tim. How are you doing?
Very well. We're doing very well. Thank you. Tonight, you wanted to talk about, an interesting character, Donald Ewan Cameron. Ewan Cameron, most people know him as. He was the psychiatrist, theoretical, you say groundbreaking psychiatrist, you could say. He was born in Scotland in 1901, and he began his career as a resident surgeon at Glasgow Infirmary. But in 1929, moved to Canada to work in Brandon Mental Hospital. In 1936, he became a director of research at Worcester State Hospital in Massachusetts, so he came to the United States. In 1938, he was appointed professor of neurology and psychiatry at Albany State Medical School, so he has quite a resume. During the Second World War, he began working for the Office of Strategic Services. So here we have a member of the subject of the British Empire working for the United States, working for the OSS. In 1943, he went to Canada and established a psychiatry department, that's curious, during the war, at Montreal's McGill University, director of the Allen Memorial Institute, which was later implicated in experiments on some patients under the guise of MKUltra and also some other programs with the Canadian government. He also had a curious experience during the war. He apparently examined and interrogated Rudolf Hess and worked for Alan Dulles in Europe. So he had that background. Of course, under MKUltra, he tested his theories on, I guess it was called depatterning, where he'd scrub people's brains clear. He took some patients that went in for some minor things like postpartum depression, anxiety, and destroyed their minds. And this was funded by the CIA through the Human Ecology Fund, I believe. And also through, interesting enough, through some Department of Education grant or Department of Health Education Welfare grants and some other government agencies, the DOD, of course. So it shows
and
you
Rockefeller's,
how.
Rockefeller's.
And the Rockefeller Foundation shows this. Yeah. It's kind of a wide. And also a lot of money from the Canadian government as well. Most money came from the Canadian government. And it is said that he was operating in Canada because the CIA didn't want to break the law and experiment on U.S. citizens. Yeah, right. So
that
anyway,
doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, that's Ewan Cameron. That's his experience at MKUltra. He died, I believe, in 1967, having a heart attack while on a skiing trip. So, how do you want to enter this discussion?
Well, he's something that really should be understood. I mean, it's just, you couldn't have an individual that's more important, in my opinion, to get a good grip on. Cameron is important because he spans and was integral to two absolutely central narratives, basically. One of them was tangential, and that is the MKUltra stuff. And so basically, MKUltra, even though, it has this concept of it being, studying basically individual psychological people, and the idea has come about that it was going to create, a Manchurian candidate or mind control puppets, it was also against culture in general, right? I mean, it was basically, when you look at, the work of Gordon Wasson and the MKUltra funding, you can see that the science was, going to be applied on a vast scale. And we've talked about, where this vast scale psychological operation has various strands, that you can trace it back. But Cameron was very famous because he got caught. And it really led to a lot of the research that has become, the new history that is emerging through the alternative media, which is that the whole counterculture was a government or secret society operation, right? And the reason why Cameron was so central to that is that he got caught. It's kind of a long story, and it's not kind of what I want to get into, but basically people were able to bring testimony, and there was enough corroboration that it was just inescapable that Cameron had done this patterning, which was basically using humans to see if he could erase their mind, their memory, and then recreate a new human being, basically a new mind. This was done without their consent, obviously. No one would consent to this. So it was experimentation with a very strong moral authority. In other words, Cameron was taking the position that, you know, my science is more important than your existence, right? This is the same moral authority we see in the creation of the counterculture. I mean, who would create the Grateful Dead? Who would have the idea of doing that and have them give out millions of tabs of LSD to teenagers, which would produce, you know, wasted lives and in many cases just shattered minds? But some group does have this authority, and Cameron was part of it. Now, in Cameron's case, he got caught. They brought all this evidence, meticulous scientific evidence, you know, showing that here these people were, here are the symptoms, here is the corroborating sort of, there was some documentation on what they were like when they left by other psychiatrists who had examined them. And they brought their suits, and the CIA fessed up, and it said, okay, you know, we're going to give you a bunch of money. And so they basically bought off the victims of Cameron's experiments. So Cameron led to then, you know, a lot of research into MKUltra. And this then kind of began to bring about the idea that MKUltra was really not just individual science that could affect individuals, but on science on a broad scale. And so this was really troubling to me. And I've mentioned this a couple of times, Tim. I've said, you know, I don't understand how you and Cameron could have done the things that he did, because he is the one who brought to the world the idea of the Germans as a nation that was guilty of atrocity. Cameron was of amazingly high stature in the world of psychology. He had he was running the whole science at this time. He was the head of some world organization. He was the head of the Canadian psychological departments, and so he was called on to provide basically the science that would underline what became known as the Nuremberg trial. And so he wrote two books about the Germans. And basically, they began with some other events that we'll go into in a second, but they began the idea that there was a problem with the German race. So you had
like a congenital defect or something.
Like it was a congenital defect, right? And so he wrote these books. One of which he wrote before he arrived in Nuremberg, and the other afterwards. And this is what created the basis for the idea of German collective guilt. He said that. That we had to be certain that we would restructure the German psychology, depatterning, right, so that it would never rise as a military threat. So it was Cameron then who basically, and he used expressions like Germany needed to become the war of the world. Now, that's pretty chilling, given that the wards of his psychological clinic didn't end up too well, right?
No.
But it was his background in psychiatric practice that formed the basis, right? And of how the world then, you know, had this narrative that Germany and the German race were guilty of atrocity, mental illness.
Hey, Joe.
And that...
Hey, Joe?
Yeah.
Let me... I got a connection issue. Can I give you a call back?
Oh, sure.
Okay, then we'll just reconnect. Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Okay, so we are back.
Just had
okay,
this real
go ahead.
Problem.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I had this problem in that it was illogical. On one hand, Cameron was saying he was the one bringing us the understanding of the Germans as a nation committing atrocities, and on the other hand, he was committing the very atrocities he was accusing the Germans. It just made no sense. And then I realized that it would be logical if what Cameron was doing was in fact part of the same operation that he was involved with when he was taking funding from MKUltra, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, if he was creating basically psychological control for the organization, and he was creating the fake narratives, just like you had the fake narratives in the counterculture. You know, you have, you know, the idea that Wasson, you know, was this individual who just was interested in mushrooms, who ends up in Mexico and, you know, finds spiritual, you know, enlightenment with magic mushrooms. And then Henry Luce publishes his story. And the next thing you know, here comes the counterculture. You know, it's you go into a little bit and you can see that the story is fake and the narrative is fake and it's just being done to set us up. So that was the way that I thought, well, if that's the case with Cameron, who is part of this MKUltra, you know, system, then that would suddenly then the fact that he both was able to basically exterminate human beings, because that's literally what he was doing, and also accuse the German on the grounds of morality, would suddenly become logical. You see what I mean? In other words, now it makes sense that mm-hmm. Cameron is simply creating a fictional narrative. His moral authority is such that he can lie and he can exterminate human beings. And that would mean that Ewan Cameron was not a character from history that was deeply illogical, but rather he was just a lifetime actor. You know, we've discussed this. Mm-hmm. And so when I compared, you know, Cameron, I tried to look at sort of to the story that he brought up about the German atrocities. I looked for examples of the other aspects of the things that became the foundation of the German atrocity concept, right? You have the Nuremberg trial, you have the atrocities that were listed. I mean, and when I studied them, I found an interesting thing that this character, C.D. Jackson, had been involved with, he was from the OSS. He was later someone who worked with the CIA, and he had been the head of the OSS Psychological Warfare Department. I'm butchering the title, but he was basically very high up, and he had a relationship with Alan Dulles and was sort of Dulles's eyes on the ground in post-war Europe. And there's a picture which purports to be C.D. Jackson, and he's at Buchenwald. And there you have two of the components of the narrative, of the German atrocity narrative. They are shrunken heads, two shrunken heads, and a lamp that has a human skin for the covering of the shade. So next to it is this picture of CD. He's there next to the table. People can look at those. They're online. You can see the photographs. Now, I have seen shrunken heads, Tim, because I've lived in South America, and they are from time to time for sale in, you know, street bazaars and whatnot. And I can guarantee you that the shrunken heads that are on the table are not of prisoners from a German POW camp. They are basically, they are legitimate shrunken heads, but they are from South America. And it's easy to tell by the hair cut that the these heads have that they are not, you know, from anyone who was inside a POW camp. And the lampshade has, it's a video, and you can actually see that the lampshade does not p- possess any tattoos, which is the claim that they were human skin, which you could verify because there were tattoos. However, when the camera moves and you can see that the lampshade doesn't seem to have any. Now, both of these things, which are well known inside the narrative of German atrocities, have disappeared. It's amazing because they would be probably, you know, some of the most important historical artifacts in our history, but they've disappeared. So the fact that Jackson was involved with them is very suspicious to me because of who he was. He worked with Henry Luce. He became the publisher of Time Life, where Gordon Wasson has the story of the magic mushrooms. C.D. Jackson is the individual who created the Bilderberg Society, the American branch of it, or the American participation in Bilderberg. And then I think most importantly is he's the one who sequestered, who purchased and sequestered the Zapruder's JFK film, right? Mm-hmm. So that lineup is extremely curious. And it is made coherent by the fact that he was also part of Operation Mockingbird. Now, this is where everything starts to clear up to my mind. Because with Operation Mockingbird, you are now deep into the kind of social control that the secret society was creating with the MKUltra science, right? The Operation Mockingbird, pretty well vetted. You know, listeners can do their research, but it was basically taking control of the media by government intelligence for the purpose of propaganda, but to creating fake narratives. Mm-hmm. And now when you look backwards and you see CD's participation in the narrative of the atrocity, for it to be logical, it all has to be part of one system. C.D. Jackson is another individual like Ewan Cameron that, you know, he had the moral authority to participate in Operation Mockingbird, where the citizens were being fed false narratives for the purpose of propaganda. He had the moral authority to, you know, basically sequester the Zapruder film when obviously, you know, the population needed to see it. And so when you see him involved with the beginning of the atrocities that become part of the Holocaust narrative, the way that this is logical to me, Tim, is that you have it's all part of the same process. It's all just one narrative. And then the last curious fact I'll bring up, I'm sorry to be long-winded, but, you know, we had another shows we talked about Ed Bernays and how he talked about propaganda. He talked about mind control. And we have examples of him setting up what becomes the counterculture. And incidentally, he did work with Wasson, Gordon Wasson, for 10 years. They were very close friends. And so Edward Bernays, who is the weird double nephew of Sigmund Freud, he was clearly involved in what becomes the culturally debased anti-family, anti-Catholic, anti-ethnic community, pro, you know, feminism, pro, or Gloria Steinem's version of feminism, pro-drug use, and pro-single mom. I mean, in other words, and pro-pornography. Bernays particularly is important in the production of pornography. And so
yeah, that
and so
dates that, back to like the early 20th century, like with what Damage Gurge and Nijinsky.
Exactly right. And like the, yeah. Mm-hmm. He brings up Nijinsky, who is miming masturbation on stage, mm-hmm. and he's producing a play with Rockefeller money, mind mm-hmm. you, at the very beginning of the 20th century. And so Bernays is clearly plugged into this whole process by which a narrative about, you know, what is good, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, essentially, mm-hmm. You know, is being established. But now when you look forward... But
back then, wasn't drugs, sex, and jazz? No.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, sir.
Electric guitar hadn't been invented yet.
Yeah, that's right. Right. Rock and roll wasn't right. Yeah, it was drug, sex, and jazz. But anyway, yeah, that's how far back it goes. But anyway, so, you know, with Dave McGowan shows that there is a generational issue. And then this is obvious because we're not looking at a, you know, a project that is, you know, MK Ultra or the CIA. Or, I mean, this is a vast project. This goes back certainly to Gregor Lukacs. Mm-hmm. Lukacs, I'm wrecking the name.
Talked about
You know,
Hungary.
Yeah, and at the end of World War One, right, where he's trying to you know, produce a debased sexual education for the recently conquered Hungarian country, mm-hmm. Under the promotion of Bela Kun, and so that then becomes the Frankfurt School, which then becomes the American Jewish Committee's authoritarian personality, which then becomes the Macy Conference, which then becomes MK Ultra, and we've done other shows and we've shown all these connections. So Bernays is just absolutely plugged into it, and now when you come forward one generation, what do you get? Well, you get this weird guy, Murray Bernays. He's the nephew, right? Again, it's like one nephew from Freud, and now you have Edward's nephew, Murray Bernays. And who is Murray Bernays? Well, he creates the Nuremberg trial. The Nuremberg trial was never really intended, I mean, obviously, to be a kind of you know, actual trial. It was a propaganda. And Murray was in, you know, the special projects branch. And so he, you know, basically designed the Nuremberg trial. And with the idea that they would just have the impression of an actual trial, but none of the people could really bring evidence in their defense. And then at the end of it, they would be, you know, made guilty, and then you'd have this propaganda moment. So this is very clear, unfortunately. When you look at C.D. Jackson, and incidentally, one interesting thing about C.D. Jackson that I found in doing research is that Jackson's not his real name. His real name was Jacobson. He was Jewish. Now, there's some dispute about this, but the source is primary. It's someone who lived next to him at the Dakota Hotel. And in a book about the Dakota, that individual is questioned, and he has absolutely no reason to lie about it. I mean, it's going to be in a public document. And he goes, well, you know, and he was talking about C.D. Jackson, his next-door neighbor. And he said, yeah, it's really interesting. C.D., you know, his name wasn't Jackson. It was Jacobson. He was Jewish. And he was, his father owned something called Jacobson's Marble. And now this has been scrubbed, very mysterious. Hmm. Like to have some citizen researchers help with this, to vet this this idea. Very important to know this, because if this is correct, and I think it is because of how primary and clear the, you know, the documentation is, and also the fact that C.D. Jackson stated that his father was in the marble business, right? Doesn't say he changed the name, but the fact that he was in the marble business, I've been able to verify. So this looks pretty clear. So that's why when you get to basically the Nuremberg trial, you have you know, this like a very clear picture of a narrative being created now. You know, people will talk about Holocaust denial, which, of course, is illegal in many countries, mm-hmm. which you know, is sort of suspicious in and of itself. I mean, if their evidence was good, why does it have to be illegal to discuss it? But it is. But this really isn't, you know, something that I think, you know, it's sort of like the historical individual that's kind of has been, there's a mythology that develops around. People will argue, well, was the individual historical or not? And to me, and this is, you know, just to, so I can explain this clearly, it's like, you know, the person who created the cartoon character Donald Duck had a duck that his neighbor owned, whose name was Donald, right? Okay, now, does that mean that Donald Duck, the cartoon, is a historical character? Well, no, I mean, it's a semantical issue, and, yeah. and you can't answer it. It's like, well, in some ways he could be, but the fact is that the historical Donald could not talk, right? He was not able to speak English. So it's fiction, but it's not completely fiction. And so you have this like with historical characters, you know, Buddha, Jesus, you know, people are always arguing, well, you know, can you prove one way or another? You can't. It's just impossible. Mm-hmm. But what you can do is understand the genre. And a cartoon is not a history, right? And so with the Holocaust, in terms of denying it, that seems to me like the position of negation of someone who's saying, well, the Buddha could not have existed because we know that no one can live on one grain of rice a day for a year, right? Okay, well, but wait, he could have existed. This could just be an embellishment. With the Holocaust, you have this people try to attack those who want to understand what happened, to bring up, you know, this the details and facts that we know about these events, and try to see if they are in fact creating the right context, and then they're attacked on the grounds that, well, this is Holocaust denial. And so I think that that is sophistry. I think that the people who want to revisit the Holocaust because of what we have uncovered in terms of the government production of the counterculture, right, are trying to determine not whether or not there were camps, or whether or not there were Jews in camps underneath, you know, or whether or not this was morally defensible. None of these things are even on the table. The question is, to me, is were the events taken and placed into a fictional context for the purpose of propaganda? Mm-hmm. And that's what I think when you go through these three individuals that I've mentioned, Bernays, Cameron, and C.D. Jackson, I think that it is far more logical. I mean, just clearly, you know, makes much more sense to look at these guys and their activity as part of a propaganda narrative, and not one that doesn't end with the conclusion of the Nuremberg trial, but never basically ends. One that just continues to go forward until now we have, you know, even, and then the last atrocity element, which is the gas chambers. Mm-hmm. Which, when I try to do research into it, and I really have done the best I can, just makes no sense to me.
Yeah, yeah. This it's accepted as gospel. I'm reading about MKUltra, and they talk about the, you know, the Nazis, paperclip Nazis, and it's treated as if MKUltra is sort of some sort of virus that's brought in with the Nazis, as if, you know, yeah, unable as treachery, lest we bring in these Nazis to infect our you know, our system. And within this description, they talk about the experiments, these things, which may or may not have happened. Maybe they're embellished as well. Probably are. Just like the other aspects of the so-called Holocaust are probably you know, extreme embellishments, to say the least. But they're just you'll hear the thing about Zyklon B and IG Farben. And it's almost as if people are forced to include that, lest they be accused of you know, of being a denialist or and having their reputation or careers ruined, because there really is no evidence. And once you look at it, to see that IG Farben, that the Zyklon B was used, the gas chambers aren't there. In fact, Dachau, I think the C.D. Jackson and Hollywood directors actually constructed a fake gas chamber as a part of a post-war tour they'd give to dignitaries and senators.
Not to mention, absolutely,
the films that were produced, again, that's the films that were produced by Alfred Hitchcock and Billy Wilder, and just the footage we have of the bodies being bulldozed. A lot of those are air raid victims or typhus victims, and the reality is that all the film we have of the so-called Holocaust is from the Western camps, which, based on the official narrative, weren't part of the Final Solution. That all occurred in the East, and we have no film evidence of that. In fact, the aerial photography, the reconnaissance during the war, showed no such activity going on, nor are there any records, requisition records, fuel requisitions, All this, and just simply isn't the documentary or physical evidence to support that narrative. So all we have are some horror stories, largely coming from the Russian side, which I would say isn't a reliable source. So there's much there to be skeptical about, to say the least.
Yeah, exactly right. And in fact, I think that we have to put it now into the context of basically the revelations concerning MKUltra and mm-hmm. the fact that we know that our government engages in the production of narratives. I think the Gordon Wasson expose is probably the most important thing the citizens have been given, since the Roman Empire. I mean, this is really, really important for citizens to know that, because there's when you can really verify it is both completely fake and absolutely central to an enormous social program, you know, the counterculture.
Yeah, it reverberates today. Now, it reverberates today.
It still reverberates today, yeah. And that, of course, can now, you know, when you look at like, you know, the things that you've shown about the assault on the cities, how the ethnic communities, the Catholic communities in America's cities were then, these ethnic communities were deliberately attacked to break them up and to push them into the suburbs to create the vast deracinated middle class, right? That would then be susceptible to the now sex, drugs, and rock and roll at this point.
Yeah, you create the vast wasteland of suburbia where people are all going into debt with their consumer goods, but yet they still can't find happiness, and they find themselves all on anxiety medicine, you know, because exactly. They no longer have their parishes, their churches, or their ethnic lineage. They're deracinated. You're right. They're cut off, and now they have no roots. You know, nothing to appeal to, nothing to refer to, and I wonder why they're unhappy. You know.
Yeah, well, they have no capacity to resist the mind control. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't resist pornography. You know, and pornography, like the Germans are, you know, claimed to be, you know, sexually deranged, you know, and doing these kinds of activities. But then when you go forward and look at what's being promoted by the government and the counterculture, right? How the government is promoting early 70s. Then you can see that the charges against the Germans to this regard, the charges, you know, are just like the charges that Cameron made about them, you know, being a group that was capable of atrocities. For heaven's sakes, when you are actually doing what you're accusing the other individuals of being guilty of, you just don't have the moral authority. And yet they do it time and time again.
Yeah, he's standing in a rubble of a bombed out German city, lecturing the Germans on their atrocities.
Yeah.
And you're asking, well, right. Who bombed the city?
Yeah. Well, who firebombed them? Yeah, you know, I mean, who deliberately targeted civilians? And then so you see, this is the thing. It gets back to my little story about Donald Duck, is that, you know, at the end of the day, I think you'll find, a foundation of truth. I am sure Jews were in concentration.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure many of them were mistreated because there had been tremendous antagonism between German soldiers. And I don't think I don't think they would have been sought out for any special atrocities. I can't find any evidence of that.
It depends where you are, because you're mixing. When you talk about the Holocaust, they talk about the camps, the labor camps, which were industrial concerns, you know, IG Farben, IBM. Right. General Motors, Standard Oil, all involved. But then they mix in like this, these police battalions on the Eastern Front, on near the front where they're fighting these partisans. And you can't mix the two because they're two different environments. You can't mix the battlefield, you know, this raging battle to what was going on maybe in Poland or in parts of Germany. two different things. I'm not justifying what happened with these Einstein group and would go behind the line. You know, these police battalions would clear out under the guise of anti-partisan activity, killed a lot of Jews, and they wrote about it. Now, also that was their job. This was this anti-commissar order that was written up. But the way the Germans saw it, the Germans saw a lot of Jews as being Bolsheviks. So a lot of Jews were going to be killed in that battle, carnage on the Eastern Front, the level of destruction. There was
exactly right. That's well said.
Is the Soviet Union. They would carry out atrocities and blame them on the Germans. So it's psychological warfare. It's propaganda. And remember, the partisans would go out and they would kill Germans soldiers. So you're going to have a lot of, the Germans aren't going to be that sympathetic on the battlefield or that discriminatory about who they kill. And if you want to single out the Germans being particularly brutal in that factor, just look what happened in Vietnam with the Phoenix program, the search and destroy missions and these things.
Right.
You know, and multiply it by 10 on the Eastern Front because it was a much larger war. You know, it's war. And the war itself was a crime, as you say. I mean, the war itself was a crime. And, you know, to pick out this here as being somehow exceptional from some of the other atrocities, which is the war itself, to me is it's hypocritical, and you're being highly selective in your morality.
Well, worse, it's a fake narrative for the purpose of propaganda.
Yeah, because you're singling out one side as being particularly brutal. When just look at the, look at the landscape of Europe, and it takes two to tango.
Yeah, Tim, what I'm seeing is that the Germans are basically the sort of premier European people. And now you look at this false narrative that comes out of World War II, and you know it starts long before any of the data really is coming in. I mean, the concept of the German atrocity were being developed in 1942, 43. This is long before anyone has detailed information about what's going on in the camps. But the narrative is being established.
That's right. So it's being fed through, supplied through Harry Dexter White and Henry Morgenthau at the Treasury Department, because they ran the War Refugee Board.
Right. Yeah. And with Ben Heck writing stories in Reader's Digest.
Yeah.
Where in 1943, he talks about 6 million Jews at risk.
So you have a communist and a committed Zionist creating the Holocaust narrative.
Right. And so just like the gas chamber and the shrunken heads and the human head lampshades, the 6 million number is frankly demonstrably preposterous. It just is a metaphorical number representing the Jewish people. I don't know if you've ever seen any of the analysis of the use of the term, but 6 million gets used, 30, 40 times in the media, in European media. Before World War II breaks out,
yeah, particularly
representing
Russia.
the Jewish people who are at risk
they once blamed the Tsar as putting 6 million at risk,
right? Exactly, yeah. But you see, you're starting to develop a very clear understanding because the lampshades have disappeared and they don't appear in the movie to have any there's no tattoos on them. The human heads are just preposterous. I mean, the skin is black, and the idea that was, POW from World War II is just ridiculous. The gas chambers make no sense. Just numerically make no sense at all. I mean, and also mechanically. I try to go through, how they would kill all these people in these little gas chambers and then get all the bodies out and then have enough coal, whatever it is, to burn them all. And of course, then you have the question of habeas corpus. Where are all the bodies, right?
It's a whole lot of body to bury, and lots of bodies to get rid of.
Right. So again, it's, you get to the idea, they may have had gas chambers. People may have died in them, but they weren't some kind of industrial genocidal machine. Right. There just isn't any way that this can be true. And so you've got to the point where, it's like with the character Donald Duck, you now understand the genre of the story. We're not being given history here. We are being given propaganda. That's my point, Tim, is that we can be sure of that.
Well, that because, I mean, good example is if you were a prisoner or an inmate at one of these camps, labor camps, you probably saw a fair amount of brutality, people being treated harshly, even maybe summary executions. And that's your perspective. You see that. All of a sudden, you hear the story of the Holocaust, and in your mind, you've witnessed the Holocaust, although you saw something completely different. It wasn't an attempt to annihilate an entire race. It was just the type of treatment you get in a labor camp, a slave labor camp, during a war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I read, like, the Red Cross reports, which are very meticulous, you know, people can contest one way or another, but they do exist. And they actually have a number of 270,000 for the total of casualties in the camps during World War II. Mm-hmm. And they say that maybe 40% of the population were Jews. Then you have, you know, it is a tremendous tragedy, but it is not the unique atrocity that then becomes part of a very powerful narrative propaganda.
Well, it's like this. What if in the United States... If we had the reality of the intern camps, the concentration camps for the Japanese on the west coast of the United States, and that was in a tremendous injustice to take their property. In fact, I think the Hyatt Hotel chain is based on stolen property.
Yeah, Japanese, for sure.
Friends within the Treasury Department gave it to them. It was a whole Jewish mobster thing. But That was an incredible injustice to those 100,000 Japanese. Now, what from that basis? Okay, that is what it is. Okay, they're interned, then they're released. Civil rights were violated. They lost their property. These things. But what if from that reality, this narrative was spun that 3 million of them were worked to death or murdered, just in an attempt to annihilate the entire Japanese people? Would that be a fair?
Exactly.
No, that would be. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a great analogy because that's what's happened. And you see, the idea of Holocaust denier, this is just an expression to try to dominate the debate. Mm-hmm. You know, it places the person who's trying to bring this information forward as denying that Jews died in the camps.
Or bad things happened to Jews and people in general.
Right.
Yeah,
or that, or that there weren't even, you know, atrocities, right?
Or that you advocate bad things,
right?
Which just, it's really illogical.
What I'm suggesting is that the better approach is to try to not permit that concept to be something which defeats, intellectual exploration. What I think is that really you try to put on the table, particularly for the public, because, you know, in the alternative media, I think these ideas can be discussed pretty objectively right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that there really is a revisionism to the Holocaust that's just going on because there's so much bad data inside of it. Unfortunately, I think, you know, people are pointing out perhaps accurately that some of this is coming from a bad place in the heart. There is, legitimate anti-Semitism. Okay. But that has nothing to do with the idea of, are these details capable of being analyzed? You know, I mean, we should be able to, you know, have some kind of process where we can come to, you know, do the human heads look like Europeans, you know, shrunken heads. So the thing
like,
is
almost like an exasperation. Again, aren't we all adults here? Can't we talk about this?
Yeah, can't we even talk about it? So it's just that we're trying to find what genre are we dealing with. Is this a legitimate history, right? Or was this propaganda? If we are dealing with propaganda, then we need to go back and look at the details and recreate the narrative, because otherwise we are going to have a false history, and a false history leads to catastrophe, as you pointed out, you know, a number of times.
Yeah.
False history leads to catastrophe.
But this is why the narrative is being spun, though. The narrative being spun and promoted not only because so much of the post-war international establishment depends upon it, particularly the state of Israel, reparations, which are billions and billions of dollars, of the power of the Jewish lobby in the United States, the whole idea of sort of a moral extortion of the entire Western world, because this collective guilt has now spread down from Germans to the entire world. That's why you have these museums everywhere.
Right, exactly.
Specifically European, Middle European phenomenon. We have museums all throughout the United States. You know, they expect to put a museum in Iran for some reason. You know,
right.
You know.
But, well, I recently gave an example of where it you know does ill to the culture. That, I mean, the false narrative is always bad.
Mm-hmm.
Propaganda is always evil. Right. You shouldn't use mind control. You should be able to express what you want honestly, and then people can make their own minds up. It was when the Hays Code was disbanded. Now, that was the Hollywood Production Code.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was always intended to be something that would be destroyed. I think Hays was a setup. I mean, this is another, you know, body of analysis. But the code was good in its as it presented itself to the public. These were great principles. But in the early 60s, it basically was done away with. And you have to remember that the Hays Code was put into effect as a way to combat the idea that Hollywood was a Jewish debasement of European culture. Because this is really what spawned the Hays Code. Is that if you look at the, I did a, you know, an interview about this, and I was reading quotes of just blatant, you know, just attacking Hollywood as a Jewish plot against European culture. This was after the Fatty Arbuckle event, you know, and where you had all this pornography, and there were different scandals, one scandal after another. And so they brought out the Hays Code. And they brought the Catholics in, very famously. They brought the Catholics in as basically, you know, as people who had been involved in the production of the code.
Yes, yeah, so because Joseph Breen or something?
Pardon?
Joseph Breen,
I think. Yeah. And so I'm not sure he was Catholic, but so they brought it, but they had the Catholic Legion of Decency was vetting it. And so the public was being said, hey, look, we've got, you know, we don't have to worry about basically Jewish depravity against European culture because you've got this code which the Catholics have been involved with. But then in the 60s, it's disbanded.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why? Well, I suggested that it was an example of the power of the Holocaust because it just became politically impossible to bring up these concerns about one culture attacking another.
Yeah, you couldn't be critical of any Jewish organization or Jewish dominated industry without being accused of being Adolf Hitler.
Exactly right.
Well, it's interesting because the movie that broke the production code was Rod Steiger in a so-called Holocaust survivor, allegedly, in The Pawnbroker.
Yeah.
It was a Holocaust movie, and it showed the topless
prostitute. Was that Otto Preminger?
I think it might have been. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. But I do know that the movie, he was the pawnbroker. He was a Holocaust survivor. And it was alleged, it was basically a Holocaust movie and him dealing with it. So you rather artfully, you know, well done movie. But it had that scene with the topless prostitute from the front. And I think it was Cardinal Kroll, I think, of Philadelphia, who was writing about it. And they were trying to explain, the director was trying to say, oh, this is art. You know, you want to see the effect, and he says, no, don't give me that. And he's kind of a streetwise priest. He goes, "That's a thin end of the wedge here. It's ridiculous. First of all, from a standpoint of art and effect, it's much more artful to see his face, Rod Steiger's face, reaction to the topless lady, not her breasts. You just want to show bare breasts because you want pornography in movies. You know, don't give me this art crap. You know, degenerates always try to pass themselves off as artists." You know, that's an old ploy, you know, so.
Right. Well, that's fascinating because that I was unaware of that. I didn't know that it was a Holocaust film. But this makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. Very logical, because the one that I was familiar with, you know, when the code actually was assaulted a number of times. The first one I was aware of was Otto Preminger's film. But immediately after that was The Pawnbroker. And so The Pawnbroker really can be seen, I'm have some information here in front of me, is as the sex scene was really kind of the end of the production code.
Yeah.
And this is a very, very clear example of what happens when you have the false narrative, right?
Yeah.
Is that...
And by the way, 40 years later, almost 40 years later, network television, The one movie that's allowed to show nudity on network television is Schindler's List.
Schindler's List, yeah. So, but you see, so there is there. You can see the pattern is that the you know, you have a false narrative that basically sets up kind of a psychological structure,
mm-hmm.
That from which the population is intellectually impotent. They can't defend themselves because, you know, if you want to go after the pawnbroker, you're basically, you know, you're, well, wait a second, this is a this is promoting the horrors of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. How can you possibly say that this, even though you are ratcheting down your culture into pornography, the Holocaust is clearly being used as the bulwark to prevent the population from responding in the way they did, you know, in the 30s with the production of the Hays Code in the first place. Mm-hmm. So there you have it. And that's why I think it's so important that, you know, we try to move the debate from one of Holocaust denial into the question of just what genre is it? You know, is this propaganda or is this history? Because when we look at it from that, we just say, okay, what was propaganda? And then you go, well, I guess the gas chambers are propaganda. I guess that at the end of World War II, when you look at C.D. Jackson sitting there with his two shrunken heads and his human lampshade lamp, which are fake, right? And you know damn well the guy is producing propaganda because this is the guy who founded the Bilderberg, who sequestered, the Bruder film and was member of Operation Mockingbird.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this whole life is just is production of fake narratives, right, that control the population.
Mm-hmm.
So here he's just in perfect logical character. He's doing exactly what he always does. And so you know that these things, you know, you can rest assured that these things are just part of this idea of producing the concept that the Germans, that they were en masse engaging in atrocities. And this is being done to create a psychological intimidation so that the Europeans will not then resist the coming secret society control vis-a-vis the political system.
Yeah, and of course, you alluded to it earlier. You may want to expand upon it, how there was specifically targeting the Germans because they're central to European identity. Obviously, the war guilt has completely psychologically decapitated Germans as part of any ethnic pride or national pride for the German state, the German peoples. And we see it today now because it makes you unable to articulate, if you're a German without coming across as a Nazi, any discomfort with the migration of foreigners into your country.
Yeah, I didn't mean to. You made such an important point. I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, go. Yeah, I mean, you alluded to it earlier. Just
But what you're pointing out that with the Muslim immigration, mm-hmm. which is completely irrational and culturally destructive, that the Germans cannot resist it because they will be beaten down by the people who say, well, this is multiculturalism, and you're promoting racism. And this is Nazism, and this therefore would be like a second Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
Back to your Holocaust.
I was talking to a German lady last year about it, and she was talking about some of these right-wing political movements that are rising in Germany. And you know, she's a pleasant older lady, but she's a product of post-war Germany. She has no sense of she thought it was just horrible that some people would treat people emigrating into Germany that way or be opposed to it. Of course, she's not living there, but it's and part of that is because she somehow thinks her people, her country, are uniquely guilty of a horrible crime, and to her,
she's guilt. She is victimized by the false narrative. Yeah. It's like you said, if you actually compare atrocity for us, even everything that is known. And you know, about German atrocities in World War II was equaled by the Allies and then exceeded by the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the idea that there is some kind of, you know, possibility that the Germans were uniquely deranged, you know, the stuff that Ewan Cameron accuses them of is simply preposterous. And the poor woman, you know, that to live a life victimized by that false narrative. I mean, hopefully, you know, we can get enough information out that people will start standing up for themselves and start demanding that they, you know, people go back and learn the real history and learn to distinguish between the false narrative and the propaganda so that they can have a clear mind, you know, because mm-hmm. when you look at, you know, well, why are they bringing the Muslims, you know, into Europe? Where they're doing it, this is weaponized immigration.
Yeah.
It's not going on for the benefit of anyone, not even for the Muslims who are coming in. This is going to be a gladiatorial pit.
Well, there's a book written, you know, Kelly Greenhill, Weapons of Mass Migration, that talks about this as a part of statecraft and geopolitics. I mean, it's rather, written rather coldly, like, this is what you do.
And the thing is, when you get, we have to, you know, the concept of weaponization, where, you know, they want to shatter the culture for the purpose of control. What is the purpose of control for? Well, it's to genocide, right? So when you look at them promoting multiculturalism, well, multiculturalism is terrific. Feminism seems like, in a lot of ways, terrific. What's wrong with this? Well, if it's weaponized to be used as an element that is stated to be good, but is being inserted into culture in such a way as to produce impotent citizens that can be easily, you know, controlled and destroyed and attacked, then it's wrong. Then the citizens have to respond against it. Mm-hmm. And this is what we're looking at. And that's why I think that, you know, the stuff we've been talking about with the reviewing the elements of the German atrocities to see what was used as propaganda, you know, after World War II, you know, is really very liberating. It makes for much clearer minds. I was looking at a video, and it showed a very emaciated POW, and they were highlighting his leg, which was just emaciated, like, you know, he hadn't had any food and was about to die of starvation. And then it suddenly stopped, and into the scene appeared Billy Wilder. and then, you know, then everyone is sitting and talking, and it gets reshot. Now, this is propaganda, mm-hmm. you see. Billy Wilder is not there as a historian, right? He wasn't brought there to create an accurate history. He was there because he creates fiction. He's a propagandist. He's also a Freemason, and you know, just a bizarre character, but this is why he is there. And that's why, you know, when you look at it, just by an amazing quirk of history, it is another Bernays who is structuring the Nuremberg trial, right? You can rest assured you're not dealing with a process that's attempting to find the truth. It's a process to create propaganda. Mm-hmm. You see, this is what the family does. So we have been, you know, basically led into a debased and a weakened condition by a system of propaganda that it's easy to trace all the way back to Gregor Lukacs after World War I and even before that. So, you know, people just need to, you know, find the energy to do the research, to verify, you know, everything that we've been saying so that they can, you know, do their own research and get, you know, information that's now available and clear their minds up, Tim.
Mm-hmm. And this, you mentioned, I mean, you know? You mentioned that, of course, C.G. Jackson, his role in Mockingbird, which I think dates around 1949, which is pretty much right after the CIA was created. So that program was instituted immediately after the CIA was created. Of course, you also had Frank Wisner, who referred to his effort, his ability to manipulate the American people through the media, the mighty Wurlitzer. He could play the people like a Wurlitzer organ. This was done, you know, through the control of the media, through CIA, Mockingbird, and also through the Time Life Empire, which, you know, goes back to Henry Lou Skull and Bones. All goes back to the same secret society that created outfits, you know, which created things like the CIA, which is sort of this consummation of this sort of this incestuous incestuous relationship that, you know, these families, the financial interests, the banks had with government, you know, going way back in history, particularly, you know, in at least American history at that time, because you saw that in the Spanish-American War, the bank, you know, the National City Bank worked with the, you know, with the newspapers, the yellow journalists to foment that war so they could seize the sugar fields in Cuba and also go expand into Asia and then work with the Japanese for a while till they turned on the Japanese.
I mean, you have like the first, you know, like heads of the CIA, you've got Donovan, Dulles and Helms. Well, what is their, you know, like common theme? Well, they're all investment banking attorneys.
Yeah.
You know, well, wait a second. This is supposed to be, you know, international intelligence organization. We can't, how come every single one of them basically is a manager of money using legality? It just seems preposterous. And then, of course, Donovan is working with the head of the OSS in Europe, which setting up things like, you know, the Nuremberg trial. And this is Mellon. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like General, whatever, you know, Colonel Mellon, who's like the Zion of the Mellon family. I mean, the influence of the banking families inside of this mess is self-evident. And it's just another clear point that the public needs to recognize to understand that it is a organized society. The democracy we have is fake. Decisions were being made based on the propaganda. Mm-hmm. I mean, the woman that you talked about who believed that the Germans had somehow uniquely, you know, committed crimes against humanity, you know, that's an individual that can't participate in democracy reasonably because they have the false history.
Yeah, because her guilt is so pathological and so internalized that the assault on her own community, her ethnicity, she can't even she can't articulate an argument. She can't even feel it.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's why when you see like college kids, women who are, you know, victims of cultural Marxism that, you know, want to, you know, basically, you know, physically defend safe spaces that, you know, so they can have, you know, kind of, you know, just these culturally destructive organizations. And, you know, the whole history of how these ideas came into that person's head needs to be exposed to the individual so that then they can go, oh my gosh, you know, I have been controlled.
Well, these are like
heading off a cliff.
Yeah, these are like foundational beliefs. It's very hard when you come across something as, you know, as defining as the Holocaust narrative, and you find out that it starts to crumble under scrutiny. All of a sudden, your worldview starts to crumble, and what happens is you're not.
What are you going to do? Well,
what are you gonna, I got to get to work because I can't trust these institutions that educated me, that informed me, the media. So you have two choices. You can say, no, this is insane. I'm not going to hear it. I'm just going to go back to where I think the world is because I've already invested so much time into it, and it would require me to go back and reevaluate so much. I don't have time nor do I have the inclination to do this. I'm not going to do this. I'm much more comfortable with the moralistic fairy tale I've been given, and so I'm not going to hear anymore. Yeah. You let your world crumble, then you realize, you can't rely on the universities to educate you, and why am I paying for it? And you can't rely on the constituted legal authorities to protect your rights. You can't rely on government. You can't rely on the media. You can't read the newspapers or the mainstream media rely to inform you. I mean, I have to start thinking. I'm all of a sudden you're kind of stuck in a sort of a befuddlement because now where do you get your information from? It becomes very confusing and bewildering. And if you're of like most people, you just want the media to kind of distill the news for you, provide it for you, put a little package, wrap it in a little bow and say, this is how the world works. Most people want that because they have to go to work. And then when in the leisure time, either they do something with their family or they want to be entertained. And who has the time to hold these psychopaths accountable? That's the big problem. No one has the practical time to hold these psychopaths accountable. And this is why self-government rule of law, democracy is such a sham, because no one puts the time in to hold these crooks and psychopaths accountable.
You know? They don't have the time, and they don't have the capacity, and that's why, of course, the internet is so dangerous to the oligarchs, because one, the citizens can communicate with one another, as, for example, us now with the people who are listening to the show, and moreover, you can get vast amounts of information very quickly, you know, and if people start thinking clearly, then it becomes very dangerous, because, you know, I think when you have someone, for example, like the individual you were talking about, who's confused, hard to reach them, even with, you know, facts and, you know, clear analysis. But as people start to move down the path you described, you know, starts out with a little bit of humility, and it's very humbling. Yeah. You go, oh my gosh, you know, I can't believe this. I've been fooled. Very, very humbling. I remember when I, you know, spent like a very bad couple of months looking at the Building 7 collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had to do this kind of bizarre mental shift, thinking, you know, that I'd been dealing with, you know, the government and my nation the way I had been told about it. And then suddenly I realized, wait a second, it's completely fake.
Yeah.
You know, and that was very difficult. And it's gotten better, though, because now there, at that time, there really wasn't, you know, the alt media hasn't really blossomed. But now it's just, you know, basically it's spreading everywhere. And so, you know, groups are becoming established. People are resisting. And the basic natural capacity of the human intellect is being unleashed.
Yeah. If you don't believe that buildings can be hit by airplanes and aviation fuel can cause them to collapse, free fall, and symmetrical collapse, you may be skeptical when the doctor says your newborn baby should be given hepatitis B shot. But I find the same people who don't doubt babies being given hepatitis B shots under the cover of vaccines also don't have no problem with watching these buildings collapse, free fall, and symmetrical collapse, suffering asymmetrical damage.
What a great,
you know, it's like,
in your interview with April Bowden, you come to that point, and it's just so, so profound. It's like, look, if they're going to be giving newborn males, you know, vaccines against sexually transmitted disease, then the whole system is completely fake.
Why do I want to do not touching me? Get away from me. You're a quack. You're a nut.
Yeah, just get out. And so that's the moment. It's when the citizen, you know, just I don't know how to bring it about. I wish I did, Tim. I wish I could find, you know, some way of expressing the research I've done or the thinking that I've done about these things in a forum that would help people get the light turned on. Everyone basically has to go their own path, I imagine.
Yeah. Well, a lot of agile, I guess, when if I talk about these things in mixed companies, if you raise questions, ask something, they act as if you think you have the answer. No, I'm saying I don't.
Right.
I'm just pointing out these inconsistencies, these problems. Explain this to me in the context of the official narrative we've been given. I'm pointing out that what you the narratives we've been given are false.
Right.
Based on half-truths or outright lies. And the best lies are actually half-truths or partial truths.
Yeah, we're trying to investigate to determine the genre.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, truth is something that, in the absolute sense, is something that isn't even possible. We're just trying to determine what is the damn genre.
Mm-hmm.
Is it propaganda? Is it mind control? Or is it history? If it's history, there's a very precise scrutiny that it can be placed under, and it can satisfy the criteria of analysis. There should be no prohibition of analysis of what is history. The fact that all of these countries have created laws against, questioning the Holocaust is an absolute assertion that it is propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
Because history never has a problem being scrutinized. Propaganda always does.
Mm-hmm.
And all we're trying to do is we say, look, we've got all of these elements that are built into this German maniac atrocity storyline about their behavior in World War II and the Holocaust. And all of these details seem to be ahistorical, but they all work in terms of propaganda. So the question is, what is the genre? And it just, to me, it's just self-evident, and particularly when you show all these connections. And just, I mean, C.D. Jackson is a propagandist, right? Yes. That's what he does.
And the entire the post-war network news establishment,
right,
slithered out from Office of War Information, OSS, Walter Cronkite, Sarnoff, William Perelly,
Herbert Marcuse,
media, entertainment, the whole thing that rely on our world, you know, that how we are supposed to understand the world, you know, is seen through their lens, you know.
Yeah.
And to take it as gospel is ridiculous. I mean, just think about it for a couple of seconds.
Well, it's sort of like saying, well, gee, I mean, Bernays created the Nuremberg trial, so I guess I should really treat it as objective history.
Yeah. Even though we now know that people were tortured and coerced.
Yeah, and also, well, wait, doesn't this family just create propaganda? Didn't they invent the term?
Didn't he write a book?
I mean, don't they talk about, you know, how like a small group of people can control the ways that everyone understands history?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. So this in and of itself should just raise a little red flag. We are dealing with propagandists. When they wanted to document, right, did they bring in a historian or a fictional filmmaker? I mean, the people who created these videos, it's Billy Wilder, folks.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the guy that created the scene with Marilyn Monroe on a street grill with her dress billowing up.
Mm-hmm.
This is what the guy does. He creates scenes for emotional effect. He's not a historian. He's not a historian. It is not history.
Yeah, these videos. Steven Spielberg. He won the brought us the movie about
with
the Holocaust.
Schindler's List.
Also brought us a movie about dinosaurs that are alive.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
You know.
Yeah. So it's just that we have to flip the bit, you know, and just say, you know what? Too much propaganda, too little history. We're going to change directions here. And the citizens are going to, as a group, say, you know what? We want to revisit this whole thing. We want to go back and look at every single detail. And don't hit us with the idea that, you know, we're Holocaust deniers. We're not. We just want to know the genre that we're being subjected to.
Well, that term wasn't used until the 70s. I think Martin Gilbert wrote a book called The Holocaust, and there was the CBS miniseries, Holocaust.
Yeah.
Prior to that, it wasn't used in the historiography of the Second World War. It wasn't so centered around the Holocaust. Now it is. It's Nazis and Jews and the Holocaust. And, you know, World War II was a global conflagration. It meant different things to different people because they experienced it differently. Certainly it was different for the Americans on the home front than if you're in Europe, you know, where it was being fought, or in Asia. It's different if you were your experience of the war was different if you were an air raid victim in Dresden, or if you were an inmate at a concentration camp or a labor camp, or if you were on the, a soldier on the Eastern Front. And your idea of who was good and who was bad differs. I heard an account of some ethnic Georgians, I believe, during the 1942 campaign. The Germans, the Wehrmacht, liberated a train that was headed east to Siberia, to the Gulag. And they liberated these people and saved their lives. From the Russians, you know, so their understanding of who was bad and who was good in that war is very different than maybe a Jewish Pole, a Polish Jew. If you were an Indian and starving to death because of the British policies when they were stealing all the food out of Bengal in 1943 to export it to England, and your family starved to death because of the forced famine at the hands of the British, your idea of who was good and who was bad is different from that war. So it's a very complex event. It isn't simple. And that should, obvious.
That's right. And what happens, see, to me, it's like, okay, so the question is how many of these elements have to go into dispute or question marks? I mean, the gas chambers, if you subtract that from the narrative, the lampshade. What about the human experimentation, right, that seems to have been exactly the foundation of the MK Ultra human experimentation, right? And then the number of people killed in the camps. I mean, what about this, the, you know, like the Red Cross's, you know, estimate for, you know, 100,000 Jewish deaths. In other words, if the 6 million goes away, if you start losing the details, if they start disappearing as historical elements, if they start being exposed as, well, it's just propaganda we're trying, how many of these things have to disappear before the Holocaust then doesn't have the psychological power that the people who created the propaganda wanted it to have? You know, how many of these elements, I mean, you know, if we really, if people go, well, gee, Bernays created the Nuremberg trial, is that something you can really trust? I mean, C.D. Jackson, the guy who set up Bilderberg and who was, you know, Henry Luce, Skull and Bones, who created the Gordon Wasson, you know, fake narrative to set up the counterculture. I mean, you can't trust C.D. Jackson, right? Mm-hmm. And then Ewan Cameron, he's writing these stories about the German people as these atrocity creators and there's something deranged. Well, wait a second. Ewan Cameron is MK Ultra human experimentations that are so vicious that it's even hard to talk about them, right? So I guess he's gone too, right? Well, then now wait a second. What's left of the propaganda? You see, the propaganda power starts to disappear. You know, you're still left with the historical details. You know, we're not denying anything. We are simply going through and trying to make sense of the what has been asserted and which can be basically put as either false or as a question mark, and then looking at what's left to see, well, how much political power does the propaganda that tries to come from something that is closer to history have. Mm-hmm. And you see, my point is that it has none. And that's really what people are afraid of. And that's why they've made these laws, you know, so people can't study it.
And all the movies. Because, yeah.
Yeah. You know, and they're constantly trying to reinforce the, you know, the power of the Holocaust with these films and stuff, because they know it can't stand any real scrutiny. Yeah. It's simple. It's clear as a bell to me. It's just, they know it can't, because they know that if one or two of these details starts to collapse and then people go, well, I'm going to look at another detail, it doesn't take many for people to realize it's propaganda. It's not history. And that's why the shrunken heads and the lampshade business, I mean, those are very valuable things. Those are like the pay requisitions for MK Ultra.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Because they're so obviously fake, and they show that there was an attempt to create propaganda at the very day that the U.S. arrived at the so-called concentration camp.
Yeah.
The very day. So they had this in mind. The propaganda has been going full force since the very beginning.
Well, to this day, the camps are now, you know, the camps are now theme parks.
Yeah.
Auschwitz is a gift shop.
It's insane.
Merchandising. Yeah. Merchandising, my boy. But you know, I was talking about this very subject of skepticism towards the official narrative of the Holocaust and the problems with it. And someone says, well, I've been to the camps. I said, you've been to the concentration camps. There are camps in the United States. What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. Yeah. And it says that it's now established that they did construct fake gas chambers for people to tour in the Western camps.
Sure. What we're looking at now is no more real than Schindler's List.
Yeah, well, it's a movie. That's how most people's view of the world is through the lens of Hollywood.
They get it from Hollywood. They get it, which is just basic. Now that Hollywood can be exposed as just an arm of the secret society, people should turn off that crap. You know, I have said over and over again on our show that you know, just turn off legacy media, as it's called. Legacy media, you know, because it's not, it looks like a cesspool. You go, gee, it's pornographic, it's stupid. Mm-hmm. It's not a cesspool. It's a weapon. Mm-hmm. There is clever intent in back of it. And when you subject yourself to, you know, Schindler's List and to, you know, some debate about Holocaust deniers that's being held on CNN, you're just being, you know, in a kind of mental grinder that's just, you know, pushing you in a certain direction. this isn't how you're going to get to a clear mind, you know? Mm-hmm. You get to a clear mind by realizing that, you know, that propaganda is in play here, and then trying to do your own research to find out what which one of the elements is believable,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how many of them have to become either a question mark or just patently fake before you realize that, gee, I've been, you know, suffering from the effects of propaganda, like that poor lady you described.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, Joe, I think anything else? I think we covered it.
Gave it a pretty good thumping. I was happy to have this conversation. I've been wanting to talk about this for some time, and I'm glad I was able to talk about it with you, Tim. This is very interesting to me, and we'll see how people respond to this.
Yeah, so I'll probably be called a Nazi.
Yeah, me too. We'll try to point out, well, we're not Holocaust deniers.
No, we're
just seekers of the truth. You know, that's really what we want to do. And I think that, you know what, they'll have a hard time because, you know, it's so easy to show the how propaganda is being created through all of these different individuals and all these different false elements that they're putting, that the search for the question about what part of it is propaganda is so obvious and righteous. No one can stand up, you know, against that search for very long. It's time to happen, Tim.
So much of the propaganda, I think your analogy about Donald Duck is valuable there, because there was a duck named Donald, and you guess you could call him Donald Duck, but he wasn't the Donald Duck of Disney that we're all aware of, nothing close to that.
We can't, you know, they'll say, oh my God, you're denying the camps existed. You're denying that Jews died in the camps. We are trying to find the genre.
Yeah.
What is the intent of the people who are weaving all of these details into a story that we then, it becomes our narrative about history. What was the intent of these people? What was the intent of C.D. Jackson? What's the intent of Ewan Cameron? What's the intent of Bernays?
And it could be that the use of Zyklon B and insecticide was there to deal with lice, therefore to knock down the typhus problem, as opposed to this idea that it was applied to mass extermination.
If they want to talk about that one aspect,
yeah,
okay, fine, but you know,
where's the evidence?
Let's go through the evidence. This is great because this would be an empirical,
yeah,
you know. Is there enough? First of all, where are the bodies? Where are the bones?
Yeah.
Where are the records of population reduction? Why does the Red Cross not seen any of this? Where, you know, and then so the evidence becomes, you know, the videos of the bodies being pushed into, you know, I mean, is that, what is that an evidence of?
Yeah, what is that?
It doesn't show the violence. It doesn't show what led to the event. It just shows a big pile of corpses. I'm sorry.
Skinny, emaciated, sick people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That doesn't tell us anything. Germany was full of people like that. It's called a famine. That's one thing war creates, is famine, especially when everything, you've been bombed back to the Stone Age.
Yeah.
You know,
and so that's the thing, is that you don't need to have many of these elements. And that's like with the gassing thing. I hadn't really done a lot of work in it, but I did some work this week trying to make some sense of it. It's completely absurd. I mean, the case that it is clear history is absurd. Right? There just is not clear evidence that, well, we can absolutely be sure that 6 million Jews were put into gas. And no, sorry. You know, I don't see where where are the bones, first of all? So, you know, well, they were incinerated. Where? How?
Yeah.
You know, what rate?
With what fuel?
Yeah, and where is the fuel to do this? Right. And so like I say, it's what we're dealing here is Propaganda, not history.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, Joe, I'll let you go.
And all right, brother. Well, thank you so much. We'll get them next week, okay?
Next week. Take it easy. Enjoy your weekend. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye. Thank you.